Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be chatting with Adam Boileau in just a moment about all of the week's security news, and then we will be doing this week's sponsor interview. And this week's show is brought to you by Remediant. They make a PAM solution, which isn't awful. And yeah, Remediant co-founder Paul Lanzi will pop along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about how they've actually integrated their PAM stuff with EDR stuff. They started out with a Carbon Black integration, but have plans for the others. And yeah, if you're wondering why on earth would you integrate a PAM solution with EDR, well, this is the interview for you. And in retrospect, it actually makes sense. If a box has been popped, then some accounts have too. So tying these two things together, throwing some automation at them, it's a pretty good idea. That interview is coming up after the news segment with Adam Boileau from CyberCX, which starts now. And Adam, geez, Acer having a pretty bad time. We're going to kick off this week's show with a bit of a ransomware roundup.
Yeah, Acer got themselves compromised by the Revil ransomware crew who are asking for a smooth $50 million US. Of course, if they don't hit the deadline to pay that, it goes up to $100 million. Researchers have actually dug up the bit of the darknet portal where the negotiation is happening. So you can kind of see the chat between Acer and the ransomware crew in real time. And it doesn't look like negotiations are going super well for them.
No, it does not. And yeah, Catalin Kimpanu has the write up there. I think someone from Malware Bytes helped him out. Marcello Rivera from Malware Bytes helped him out, and they've got some juicy screen grabs and stuff in there. Staying with ransomware, and Sierra Wireless apparently also experiencing a ransomware incident, and some DC area event management firms.
Yeah, Sierra Wireless reporting that they had some issues in their manufacturing plants, a ransomware in the actual production, which may cause them some significant problems. And Spargo, this event organizing firm based in DC that does a bunch of stuff for the US military, organizing events for them, got themselves ransomware. And they put out a statement that said, quote, "As a result of cyber attack, the majority of our servers and files were encrypted and our backups were unusable. Utilizing a third-party investigation firm, we obtained a decryption key from the attackers, and the decryption of our systems is ongoing," which is a pretty weaselly way to say, "Hey, yeah, so we totally just paid the extortion fee."
But they paid through a consultancy, Adam, so they didn't directly pay it. It's okay. Fine.
Obtained the decryption key for money, which is to say paid.
I had to guess, I think you're on the money there. Now to some ransomware adjacent stuff. The list of Excellian victims keeps growing. Shell, the energy company, also looks like it was impacted. And this story here from CyberScoop lists a number of other victims too. It's just, as we expected, drip, drip, drip.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same story as usual. The Klopp ransomware crew stole a bunch of the data. They're kind of trying to ransom it back. Shell is saying that a bunch of personal data around Shell stakeholders and subsidiaries was stored on the Excellian, so the sort of thing you would imagine them sharing with external parties. And yeah, just adds to the list of people that are having a bad time thanks to that product.
Yeah, and Lorenzo over at Vice is reporting that Flagstar Bank, which got Excellian'd, we already spoke about them suffering a data loss incident, but it looks like they're going out and now notifying their customers that they lost their SSNs, et cetera, et cetera. Although, Lorenzo's written this up as a ransomware incident, but it looks really like it is the Klopp crew, but it is an Excellian-related hack, not ransomware.
Yeah, and I think the previous reporting was that they'd lost data related to their staff, and now they've changed the story and said actually there was a bunch of customer and previous customer data stored on the Excellians, and they've lost SSNs of customers to go with just the SSNs of their staff, which not a great look. And there's, of course, a bunch of people who are pretty salty about that, which is entirely reasonable.
Now we're going to look at a story by Shannon Vavra at CyberScoop, which is reporting that, the wheels of government, the wheels of diplomacy grind very slowly, but they do grind. It looks like finally there are some groups looking at how to handle ransomware from a sort of multilateral standpoint. And, this is long overdue, but there are some policy working groups and whatnot looking at how to deal with this, particularly, when you've got this issue of a bunch of criminals operating with impunity from jurisdictions that don't allow extraditions, what can you do about that, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a good write-up on where things are at the moment.
Yeah, and kind of looks at the various options they've got, you know, in terms of, you know, kind of tackling it at intergovernment levels, you know, trying to push people to not be safe havens for criminal operators, looking at attacks against the technical infrastructure, sort of, you know, combined takedown efforts we've seen against, you know, TrickBot and Emotet, and, you know, law enforcement, more traditional, just straight up law enforcement cooperation approaches. So, yeah, like the set of options that we've got. But as you say, like, it just does take a very, very long time. And when we've got, you know, the Reval ransomware crew like giving interviews about their operation to people and just saying, hey, you know, we just don't target people in the, you know, Commonwealth independent states or other kind of Russian sphere of influence things. And other than that, we're totally fine. Yeah, it's time that these wheels start to grind a little bit snappier, perhaps.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the FBI has released its annual crime report, and you look at the numbers in it, the losses, they're pretty extraordinary. But I mean, one of the things that stands out about this is just the staggering number of dollars that go missing thanks to business email compromise scams. I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this report was quite interesting because, I mean, I was expecting to see ransomware be quite a bit higher, but, I mean, a business email compromise right at the top, you know, in the order of $1.8 billion for 2020, whereas the ransomware numbers are significantly lower. But that's probably because of the underreporting. And, you know, most people who, you know, pay through a consultancy, you know, through an independent agency or whatever else, and then, of course, don't want to go and tell the FBI, you know, I think these numbers, I mean, they were saying in 2020, something like $30 million worth of ransomware, which seems super low. Especially in light of, you know, $1.8 billion worth of business email compromise.
Well, look, we know that $30 million figure is incorrect just by looking at Chainalysis reports, right? So I think you might be on the money about the underreporting there. But I also think it's true that BEC losses could really be higher. And I think that's because there's just a lower bar to entry for that particular crime type, which means there's scale there.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that kind of email-based, you know, impersonation leading to financial fraud has just had a really long history, and there's a lot of people that are very good at it, whereas, you know, ransomware is a little bit newer, and we're still kind of getting used to how to make money out of that over the last couple of years. But, yeah, you're right. You know, when we saw how effective even the, you know, the classic Nigerian 419, you know, print scams were, there's just such a long, you know, history of doing this and doing it well, that, yeah, I'm sure it's more than what's reported.
Well, and a lot of these BEC scammers have really sharpened their approaches. I saw a Twitter thread, and I can't remember who it was, so I won't be able to link to it, but it was a bit of a walkthrough on a BEC incident that this person had investigated. And, you know, they said straight up they'd seen APT crews with less skill, right? And doing things sloppier than some of these BEC scammers. And I think that's the thing. You've got such a wide range of people doing it. Even the crappy ones are successful, but some of these like better operators, they're really good at it.
Yeah, and it's such an effective crime type, and especially when you see it in really, you know, kind of high value, like real estate transactions was a good example we saw, I think, last year sometime, you know, of targeting very large amounts of money moving around in a very kind of surgical way, you know, rather than trying to do this mass market, you know, financial scamming. So yeah, there's a lot of good options, and yeah, I'm sure they all make good money.
Yeah, well, wait till we get real-time deep fakes, right? So you can have the CEO ringing you, you know, giving you a video call telling you to push that transaction through and it's not them, right? So, you know, I reckon we're going to see some of that. We've already seen reports of people using quote-unquote deep fake audio, but I think that could spread to video and get really, especially, you know, in the age of Zoom calls and everything, and work from home even after COVID passes is going to be a feature of modern working life, even if it's not every day of the week. So, yeah, I think... yeah, that was an interesting set of numbers indeed. Meanwhile, Nigerian authorities have arrested 18 suspects over BEC scams, according to this report by Catalin Kimpanu.
Yeah, which I guess is a good example of the improvement of cooperation between law enforcement and certainly the willingness of countries you know, like Nigeria to actually go and deal with the crime within their borders, you know, rather than it being seen as a, you know, kind of acceptable thing to do, that they are actually making arrests. And they've been making arrests, you know, going back a number of years now. You know, it was a couple of hundred people arrested back in 2019 for business email and other email fraud things in Nigeria. So, yeah, good to see some progress. And that's a good example, you know, to point out and say, hey, like, this is a thing that we can cause to happen and, you know, address at least some part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I traveled to a conference in Johannesburg a few times many years ago, and I got to meet people in African law enforcement, and those were some interesting conversations, right? Because Nigeria had previously been quite successful at cracking down on various fraud types, to the point that a lot of the crooks disappeared into other countries, like Chad. They just left because it was the heat was coming, right? But there was also the issue where they would be dealing with some criminal organizations that actually did have links to corrupt police, and it was quite difficult to actually catch these guys because they would always know when you're coming for them and things like that. So it's a really law enforcement in Africa on this stuff is really quite complicated, but Nigeria probably tries harder than most, to be honest. So yeah, well done Nigeria on that one. Now we're going to talk about Exchangapalooza, and I'm kind of surprised by the headlines that I'm sitting down looking at, because it looks like a lot of these exchange servers are getting patched. I mean, this is one of those times where I'm happy to say that 2 weeks ago when we said, look, everything's going to get rinsed, it's going to be the end of the world, I'm so happy to say that I was completely wrong.
I mean, yeah, it's weird. Like, we were expecting this to go much bigger than it has. And, you know, given how much exchange was out there, and some of the numbers are pretty startling, I mean, in the order of several hundred thousand exchange box. But yeah, the reporting seems to be that, you know, a lot of things are getting patched, and, you know, given how fast, and we've seen other critical bugs, you know, over the lifetime of this podcast that have taken years to get, you know, a significant portion of the vulnerable population patched, whereas this has moved very, very quickly. And it's been interesting watching that process, which is pretty novel, I think. I don't know that we've seen this much kind of coordinated messaging and support to go and apply patches for a particular product that's being actively exploited. But yeah, I expected more drama. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of things have been owned and we haven't seen the full extent of it yet, but, you know, they didn't all immediately get deleted, which is startling.
Yeah, I mean, just yesterday I published a podcast, a sponsored one, me chatting with Mark Rogers of Okta about how, you know, these things are going to remain vulnerable for all eternity until they get ransomwared or just nuked, right? And it doesn't look like that's what's happening. There are, according to Microsoft, there are something like 400,000 Exchange email servers all over the world, and there's only around 30,000 that are still vulnerable. Interesting little thing here that's popped up in the reporting is Anne Neuberger apparently had a hand in pushing Microsoft to develop that cleanup tool, which I think is, you know, an excellent idea. And I think it is good and proper for the government to lean on Microsoft to do that. But you do have to wonder how much of that is the government trying to say, hey, look, we made Microsoft do this thing that they were probably already going to do. You know? Like, you got to wonder about that. But I mean, it could entirely be true that them leaning on Microsoft did make a difference here, but it's impossible to know.
Yeah, we don't.
Because Microsoft's exactly. Not going to come out and say that the National Security Council is lying, you know?
Probably not, no. And I guess, you know, given Microsoft's size and the interdependency of, you know, so many US government functions, you know, with Microsoft software and Microsoft services, you know, I think, you know, that relationship, I suspect we're going to see the US government kind of pushing Microsoft around a bit more firmly, you know, because letting them do their own thing when it has just such impact on the economy and on all the other things that use Microsoft software. It's like, maybe this is a sign that we are going to see increased kind of, you know, I was going to say meddling, but it's not really the right word, like increased kind of focus on Microsoft.
Mandatory cooperation. I mean, what do you call that?
I mean, it's, you know, it's the Huawei, doing it Huawei style. You know, we may see more of that from the American government towards Microsoft, which probably isn't a bad thing, right? I mean, Microsoft is in a very unique position where they have both caused and are the solution to so many of the problems that we've got. Yeah. And yeah, maybe they need to stick to go with some, you know, economic carrots.
Well, I think it's good and proper that the US government do things like this. And let's not just stop at Microsoft. I think there are many companies that could use a little bit of leaning on. I'm sure you'd agree.
Yeah, you're certainly not wrong. And I mean, some of the other examples we've seen, I mean, the F5 bugs and, you know, Juniper bugs and, you know, all the VPN bugs that we saw and Citrix. And yeah, I mean, there's so many parts of that ecosystem that, you know, do need a reminder that their stuff is real important and does very real world things. Like, it's not just software, it's all the systems that are built on top of it.
Well, we'll be talking about F5 in a little while. Yeah. So
yes, we will.
Yeah. Wired has written up done a write-up about that DearCry ransomware that was targeting some of these exchange boxes. And, you know, much as we said, I think last week or the week before, it's just sort of trash ransomware. It's not really at scale and it's pretty bad. The people running it probably don't really know what they're doing. And then we've got another write-up here from Catalin at The Record talking about another trash ransomware strain that it's apparently hitting exchange boxes. But yeah, again, like the DearCry stuff, it doesn't look like it's that well put together.
I think, was it Gossy the dog, Kevin Beaumont, was posting that one of his honeypots got hit with it, and they managed to encrypt the disk drivers so he could no longer boot it, which, you know, if you're trying to then subsequently send the ransom from your exchange box might be a little counterproductive. So he's got some recommendations for the crew to, you know, kind of improve their targeting a little bit, make sure they don't encrypt super important files.
Yeah, MalwareTech also been tweeting about that stuff as well. What else have we got here? That crew that's thought to be a Chinese APT group that was targeting the Vatican and various Catholic organizations, they've done a bit of a pivot. They're now going after 5G related information, which by the looks of things, they're trying to collect like business related intelligence, which might be relevant to, you know, Huawei's interests.
Yeah, this campaign seems to be targeting telco employees around the world and poses as like a job thing for Huawei and then prompts you to install, you know, a flash update, which, I mean, let's hope the regular Huawei recruiting process doesn't require you to download flash. But hey, I mean, anything's possible in China where flash is popular still. And then that obviously leads on to getting yourself compromised and then presumably getting your telco compromised. And as you say, whatever, you know, business kind of 5G bidding information or whatever else they're going for coming out after that. So yeah, you can see why that would line up with their interests.
Staying with China APT stuff, and Finland has blamed APT-31 for a hack against its parliament. That was a hack from last year.
Yeah, there was a compromise with Parliament back in December 2020 that led to kind of access to emails of parliamentarians and other politicians in the Finnish government. The Finnish Criminal Police and Intelligence Services have now positively attributed that to APT-31, which points the finger back at China, which is a little surprising. You kind of expect the Russians to be more up in the Finnish politics.
They probably are.
I'm sure they are as well, but it's not an either-or conversation. It's clearly a both. But yeah, China also in there. So I guess, you know, Finland's place in the world is perhaps they're a little further up the list now if they're receiving targeting from the Chinese too.
Now we're going to talk about a story from, it's another Catalan one, as usual, like half of what we report in this show is written by Catalan Kimpanu.
Hi, Catalan.
Yes, hey, Catalan, how you doing? And yeah, we're going to talk about a story from Bizarro World. Now, in this strange Bizarro World, let's call it Japan, what would be considered kind of routine privacy infractions are majorly scandalous. Walk us through this one, because I think when I read this story, it made me sort of feel sad that these types of things aren't a big deal in other countries.
So the story reports on a Japanese instant messaging application called Line, which I think is owned by some, you know, kind of SoftBank, one of the many arms of SoftBank. And they had subcontracted out some work to a firm based in Shanghai to do some, artificial intelligence related something. And this particular organization that they subcontracted to accessed a bunch of data relating to, you know, users, including contents of messages, apparently, names and phone numbers and all that kind of thing. And then this has turned out to be a big scandal because Japanese privacy law basically says that you can't do this. And the company is now, you know, out there apologizing and kind of cataloging the data that was accessed, which, you know, was something like, what, 32 different occasions. I don't say how much data. But yeah, compared to what we would see, you know, over here in the slightly more Wild West, it's a little bit sad that that we wouldn't see this type of care taken over, you know, all of our data from all of our companies being sprayed around to, you know, a million other contractors and whoever else.
Yeah, I mean, that's just situation normal, right? And yes. For this to have turned into a massive scandal where the government's weighing in and like people are, you know, heads are rolling and whatever, it's just, you know, it's quite a foreign concept. So that's cool.
Yeah, good job, Japan.
Yeah, we got a great one here from Joe Cox at Vice Motherboard. And of course, you know, one of the story themes that Joe's been working on for quite some time now is this issue of the sort of data supply chain. So location data and things like that. He broke all of those stories about like those Muslim prayer apps that were sending location data to various companies that, you know, that data was then being packaged up and bought by like the US military and stuff. He's got a great story here about the supply chain of automotive related data, and there's a lot of it, and it winds up going to a surprising number of parties. And yeah, that data looks like it might wind up in the hands of militaries.
Like, yeah, this is a really interesting story. He's talking about a company called Ulysses Group, which appears to be purchasing or somehow acquiring data from, you know, telematics systems in cars all around the world. And he goes and looks into kind of how that ecosystem works a little bit. So there's a, you know, bunch of components in modern cars, you know, many of which are made by different companies. And whilst it's not, you know, whilst you imagine, if you have a connected car like a Tesla or, you know, something that's got...
it's all, you know, of them now, Adam. Like, is, I mean, I test drove a car recently. And it gets OTA updates. It has a little SOS button in it that if you push it, it sends your location to emergency services. Like, they're all like that now. You know, I mean, Tesla led this stuff, but it's amazing that the tech that's popping up in modern cars.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's starting, I guess, is that it's not just the vendors of the cars, right? They're buying all of the components and software bits, you know, from other vendors, and they have data sharing relationships with those vendors. So you end up with, you know, people who are making components of the the entertainment system, or, you know, components of the tire pressure measurement system or whatever else, getting a whole bunch of this data. And then, of course, all of this, if you eventually aggregate it, turns into essentially real-time data, you know, tracking information about, you know, the locations of billions of vehicles around the world. And then this company is kind of pulling that together, packaging up, and then attempting to sell it onwards to other people. And so you could certainly imagine, you know, if you were in the planning department of, you know, US Special Forces, that access to, like, you know, where every Hilux is might be a useful thing to know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is just, I think Joe's done a really good job with all of this coverage of sort of highlighting the issue for policymakers where, you know, you don't just have to think about smartphone apps. This is going to become more and more of an issue. So, you know, his good work on that beat continues. Another one from Joe here. And, you know, we've spoken about that encrypted phone company, Sky, where the CEO's like, no, Machete Mike, it's all fine. You got fished. It wasn't us. Their website's been seized. BlackBerry cut off their service. They've closed down. And I think the CEO has been indicted now, but it's all looking a bit bad for Sky.
Yeah, no, they are clearly no longer providing service. And yeah, I think if you were relying on them for your crime operation, probably you're going to need to find a new vendor at this point. Because yeah, you're kind of dead in the water in terms of comms now.
It's time for this next story, Adam. last week, we spoke about some pretty serious bugs affecting F5 equipment. And, you know, really, the discussion in our Slack, at least, is like, why aren't these bugs getting more attention? They're obviously going to be exploited in the wild. And, you know, F5 tends to sit in front of some pretty big deal stuff. That exploitation is now happening. So, yeah, bad times all around for F5 customers.
Yeah, we're seeing widespread exploitation of one of the two F5 bugs that we talked about last time. The one that's being exploited is actually one that's in the, like, management interface. So hopefully most high-profile stuff that has an F5 in front of it doesn't also have the management interface hanging out on the internet. But hey, all sorts of crazy stuff happens, and you're also, you know, one internal bug away. But yeah, exploit code for this has, you know, is floating around. We've seen people reverse engineering the patches and kind of figuring out the very exact, you know, mechanisms for this bug, which is basically a, like, server-side request for you to bypass auth, leading to command injection when it goes to execute tar to unpack some, like, software updates
as
or something.
Root, so you mean
as inevitably, of course, yes. Because the insides of those appliances are like the, you know, every year since about 2002 didn't happen. But yeah, widespread exploitation of that. We haven't seen yet widespread exploitation of the other bug that I was excited about last week, so I'm still hanging out for that one to get moving as well. But yeah, if you are an F5 operator, which is a lot of people, please make sure you get them patched.
I mean, it's depressing to me because F5 do actually make some useful stuff, right? Like, it's F5 gear is really good at some things, but this isn't good enough. You shouldn't have bugs like this. I mean, they've even sponsored a couple of episodes of this show, right? And spoken about some of the things like doing, you know, WAF at scale across a bunch of different applications, being able to handle hybrid deployments, things like that. They're really good at, but they need to improve their product security. Their customers deserve better. Like, honestly, this isn't good enough, is it?
No, it's not. And what's interesting, I think, is that this particular bug style, like using SSRF to hit internal API services that are not adequately authenticated and aren't adequately input validated because previously they've never been accessible, is a result of us understanding more about, like, how to use server-side request forger or other primitives to kind of proxy requests onwards, which is because we build everything out of microservices. We're now much better at understanding how to, as attackers, understanding how to traverse proxies, reverse proxies, and manipulate
Forget about this bug. And think about the one we spoke about last week, where if you could control the response headers, you could get code exec because they don't do any sort of, you know, memory mitigations. Like, it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that the lack of modern exploit mitigation technique, that was ridiculous. But I guess where I was going with the SSRF thing is this is a pattern we see repeated in all sorts of other security appliances, like some of the Accelion bugs, for example, have been very similar in style. So this is a pattern that every other appliance manufacturer is going to see used against their products as well. So if you're an appliance vendor, you need to go and kind of relook at these internal services.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, I think the thing that's tricky with F5 is there's not really something that you can do a straight replacement with, is there?
Well, I mean, there's a reason they're widely deployed. Right? They, just, they do basically do, you know, a good job of what they're for, and, you know, that scaling like that and being able to rely on products like that to, you know, sit in front of all of your critical services and operate them in a way that doesn't cause downtime. Like, that's a set of technology, but also, you know, the skills and the maintenance and the people who understand how to drive them that is difficult to just replace with something else.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But look, you know, I know we've got some listeners at F5. You know, this is something you need to proactively get on top of instead of just waiting for the next bug report, because we've seen other stuff, similarly awful stuff in your gear popping up with at a pretty regular tempo lately.
Yeah, and you don't want to end up being like Cisco, where you're the butt of the joke, right? Where the leading provider of high-graded creds, you don't want to be the worst security appliance vendor of all time. So,
get cracking. That's what we say. Project Zero has done a write-up on some mysterious group that is exploiting a whole bunch of different bugs, including a whole swag of O'Day. And yeah, basically Google has written up this group of, like, well, without attribution, but they're saying, here's what this group is doing, and they're really good at hacking stuff. So it's fun times, this write-up.
Yeah, there's been a couple of blog posts from P0 researcher Maddie Stone looking at this set of exploits and the tooling around them that Google has been investigating. And it's interesting for a number of reasons. One, obviously there's a bunch of really good zero day in there. Two, they are targeting, you know, pretty widespread set of platforms, Windows, macOS, iOS, Android, and doing so with exploit chains that go all the way through and work well. And when individual components of the chains get burnt, that they've got other bugs on the shelf to kind of swap out and replace them with, you know, a variety of different types of exploit, you know, local privacy, sandbox escapes, all the things that you'd need for a very professional operation.
Jeez, I mean, what sort of agency, I mean, you know, who could that be?
Which does, you know, it does narrow it down to a pool of particularly competent, well-resourced attackers. Google doesn't speculate about exactly who it is, but, you know, this is what a high-quality operation looks like, and one that's well-resourced.
Let's just leave it at that. Moving on, and, oh, look, it's funny, right, because Dan Gooden wrote this one up for Ars Technica. It's about a backdoor that's found its way. It's like a backdoor in a malicious Xcode project that's circulating somehow. Someone's obviously trying to backdoor iOS developers. This isn't really a new thing, but I thought it was worth talking about just to remind people that not only have Trojan versions of Xcode itself been made available on the torrents, but yeah, like, don't just load up random dev projects from randos and expect good things to happen. One thing that I'm not clear on here, because as I say, it's an Xcode project. How are these attackers getting people to run and load it, you know?
So the as part of Xcode projects, you can specify like a script that gets run during build time. So the attacker has stuck some obfuscated shell script in the kind of build chain, so that if you can't compile this project, you end up shelling your box. As to whether where these malicious projects are coming from, we saw one which was like a Trojan copy of a legit piece of iOS, like a library that a developer might use. Like, it's a thing for drawing tab bars in a particular way, and so they had added this to that and then kind of republished it. But we have seen, you know, other examples, like that one we were talking about a few weeks ago, where the North Koreans were sending, you know, like backdoor Visual Studio code projects to researchers on Twitter to go and cooperate with them. So whether it's the same kind of approach here, you know, whether you know, just kind of use social techniques, you know, to use supply chain, whatever you can do to get it in front of a developer, get in their box, presumably then steal some keys, you know, and look at what your options are for onward supply chain from there. It seems like a pretty fruitful, if kind of long game way to go and go about things.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because back in 2015, and Dan mentions this in the story, you remember Xcode Ghost? That's when someone had just basically come up with a version of Xcode that would include attacker code in any project that was developed with that version. And they just put it out there on the torrents, because apparently downloading Xcode at that time from Apple was kind of a pain in the ass. So people would just literally fire up like BitTorrent and grab the whatever rando version was available. And there was one that was backdoored, and it was a really successful campaign that resulted in 4,000 iOS apps published to the App Store having been infected by those attackers. So this doesn't look like it's as serious, but it's just, you know, as I say, I wanted to talk about this because it's a reminder, right, that attackers do tend to go after tools like that and make dodgy versions of those tools and related projects available to people as a way to own them. So, you know, something to keep in mind. Lily Hay Newman at Wired has done a write-up on Red Team X. This is a new unit at Facebook, which is sort of like Project Zero Lite. So it's their job to sort of do a lot of product testing of the stuff that gets used in Facebook and like spit out a bunch of CVEs. And it looks like a cool idea. I'm surprised more companies aren't doing this, to be honest.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense, right? If you are looking at, you know, attacking your internal network with a kind of more traditional red team, then they tend to be focused on, you know, kind of site local configuration and things that are specific to your network and environment and things like that. But if you've got developers that are building new things and they want to say, hey, like, we want to use this product in our services, like, is it any good? Going and getting that kind of analysis or having, if they've got specific security concerns about a thing that they're doing, but they don't really understand how to answer those questions, having a team that is kind of specialized at doing more vuln research and less, you know, kind of operational hacking does make a lot of sense for, especially for an organization that either builds a lot of software or incorporates, you know, kind of tooling and software from a whole bunch of other places and really need to get a good handle on what that means, you know, for them and for their developers. And, you know, anything that helps you educate the people that are building your products and support them with, you know, actionable information about the quality of the things that they're using or the pitfalls they could avoid is going to help, you know, help you develop better things.
Congrats to Vlad Ionescu, who's running that unit over at Facebook. And we look forward to reading your delicious reports when you get to shell all sorts of horrible equipment that you use. Mm-hmm. Moving on, we've got just one report here from the Daily Swig talking about how, yeah, people who are in the sort of space satellite industry are really taking a good look at how they need to rethink things now that, you know, it's just getting more and more possible for people to be able to attack satellites in space because the equipment that you need to do that has kind of been commoditized.
Yeah, there was a actual cybersecurity conference for space operators in Davos in Switzerland, which had a bunch of speakers talking about, you know, ways to attack satellite systems and the changes in kind of modern constellations, modern approaches to, you know, software-defined radio and all that kind of thing, and the effects that they have on, well, you know, I guess what has traditionally been a pretty slow-moving industry, the space world. And so there's a bunch of things to think about if you're in the aerospace industry for, you know, attacks on satellite control, attacks on ground stations, you know, attacks on, you know, even just telemetry coming off satellites. We saw people, you know, reverse engineering the video feeds coming off SpaceX satellites just this week, I think, getting some upper stage footage off a Falcon booster, which is pretty cool to see. But yeah, it's a thing that is definitely getting a bunch of focus. And we saw that competition at DEF CON last year also kind of focusing on that. So yeah, definitely a thing as we put more junk in space that we do need to think about.
A Uruguayan researcher named Ezequiel Pereira is $133,337 richer thanks to Google.
Yes, this is a researcher that's been working on, you know, kind of bug bounty stuff for the Google Cloud Platform's bug bounty program, and his write-ups of a number of bugs that he had found and reported. I think originally he got the classic like Google $3,137 bounty, but then his bug write-ups were judged the best of the year, and he won an extra prize, like $100,000 or so, that, you know, reward really good quality research. And he'd come up with some pretty sweet bugs, like once again, SSRF through to code execution and back-end APIs. So, you know, a pattern that's we're definitely seeing repeating. But yeah, he's been working on their platform for a long time and is certainly very well regarded. Although I think he's moving on to go work with Facebook's bug bounty program now. So we'll see some more sweet bugs there.
It's funny because it's all the bounty people who know how to SSRF are the ones getting paid.
Exactly, right? It's the, yeah, it's a good time.
It is. Now we're going to talk again about Tilly Kotman of Switzerland. This is, of course, APT69420 Arson Cats who hacked into that that camera company, Verkada, or whatever they were called. So, you know, last week we said, gee, you know, the US DOJ rolled on Tilly pretty quick. But it turns out Tilly Kotman has form, having hacked something like 100 companies previously. And yeah, I mean, this looks like a classic case of what we used to call reverse hacktivism, which is when you hack the company first and then you come up with the justification later to make it look like some sort of, yeah. Anyway, walk us through this one, Adam.
Yeah, so it turns out the indictment is for their earlier work rummaging through source code repositories. They came up with a scanner or a technique for identifying Git repositories and then, you know, kind of pulling the code out of them. It ran a site called git.rip, which collected source code and other information looted from source code repositories from a number of, not just Git repositories, from a number of source code repositories of companies. And then that was, you know, that's kind of pretty blatant. And, you know, they made some effort at justifying it as, you know, like freedom of information or...
anti-intellectual property, yeah. But it just seems like setting stuff on fire and then saying that it's political is just not really, I don't know, it doesn't pass muster. It does not pass muster, Adam.
Sometimes it's necessary, but it does seem a little hard to justify in this particular case. I mean, much as some of the companies on the list are, you know, not the world's favorites, but still, like, this is no justification. And clearly the US Department of Justice also feels that it's not justification.
I mean, there's a difference between setting free academic papers that people shouldn't be charging for, right? Like, that's a sort of bit of IP-related activism I can get behind versus taking Adobe, Lenovo, AMD, and Qualcomm source code and putting it on the internet. Like, that just, it's just, what?
Yeah, I mean, it's never going to go well for you, and I'm not sure what the extradition situation is from Switzerland, but yeah, this is a pretty reasonable indictment from the DOJ, and we'll have to see what it leads to.
Now, you remember last year we spoke about this guy who tried to recruit a Tesla staffer to plant malware on Tesla's network. This is something that that happened last year, and it was a big story at the time. That gentleman, a Russian gentleman, who tried to do the recruiting, is 26 years old, Igor Igorovich Khrushchev. He has pleaded guilty to that crime.
Yeah, he does look like he's going to get a slightly lighter sentence as a result of that plea arrangement. He was facing something like 5 years in prison.
I should point out too, the thing that made this newsworthy at the time is that he was offering the insider $1 million to actually plant the malware on the network.
Which, I mean, is a hell of a strategy, right? Just showing up with a suitcase full of cash outside your target and, you know, trying to pay someone to plug a USB stick in. Like, that's got to work most of the time. Like, I'm surprised it didn't. Whoever worked at Tesla and dobbed them into the FBI, you know, I mean, good on you, but, you know.
Well, Tesla seems like it's a bit of a cult, you know what I mean? So I can kind of understand how they'd say, I don't want the money, you know, I want to protect Daddy Elon. And
that's how. But, I mean, if you did it outside Oracle, I can't imagine that you'd get the same response. Yeah. Although you probably wouldn't need to anyway. Anyway, so he pled guilty, and now he's facing perhaps months in jail plus some supervision, and he has to pay Tesla $14,000 in restitution. So, yeah, not really going to buy Elon much.
Months? This guy must have snitched. Like,
I mean, presumably, like going from years to months, they must have got something worthwhile out of him as part of it, other than just
other the convenience than a plea, of not a guilty having to go plea,
through,
yeah.
through the trial. Yeah. So, interesting. If you were involved in that scam over in Russia, then maybe watch your back.
Ah, dear. Yeah. Now, last week we spoke about this cryptocurrency platform called Roll that had its hot wallet popped and $5+ million in crypto got pinched. And look, you read this story, which comes to us via TechCrunch. Zach Whitaker wrote it up there, and you just weep salty tears. Because
you do.
Oh my God. So these guys, they still don't know how their hot wallet got popped, but that's not the jaw-dropping part of this story. The jaw-dropping part of this story is they had their smart contracts like audited for security, but they didn't even pen test. By the looks of this story, if this story is to be believed, they didn't pen test their like operational environment before they went live. And you know, what are you thinking?
Yeah, this did not seem particularly well thought out, and certainly as a reminder for anyone kind of playing in the crypto world that, you know, this is how much diligence some of these companies are willing to put into securing your money, right? They not even a single pen test, like not having any of their actual infrastructure tested, just not good enough. And then it's kind of made worse by the fact that they appear to have also not actually hired anyone to do incident response. They are doing their own IR.
Yeah, because they've said they've been unable to hire someone. And I get, look, things are pretty tight in IR at the moment, given everything that's been going on. But like, really? You couldn't find anyone?
Yeah, which, I mean, I'm sure they must have talked to some people who then kind of perhaps walked away from it when you kind of see the scale of the problem, or maybe they're not willing to pay what it costs or whatever the deal is. But yeah, this is not particularly confidence inspiring. And if you had any of your money tied up with them, I would be pretty concerned.
We only mentioned it briefly last week, but there was a Microsoft 365 outage, and it looks like, of course, because this is how outages happen in 2021, it was a key rotation screw-up that resulted in that. It can happen to anyone.
Yeah, Microsoft posted root cause analysis on their blog, which said that they had some key material that they were using, and the automated key material removal system threw it out. So that was why Auth stopped working in Azure AD for quite some time, whilst they went and rolled back that change and then had to deal with all of the caching all over the place that makes everything actually work, caching the bad data. So, yeah, certainly a rough day in the ops minds over at Microsoft, and my condolences to whoever is responsible for key management there, because that sounds like a rough day at the office.
Well, it's funny, right? It was a rough day at the office for them, but my Twitter timeline during that outage was split evenly between people who are stressing the hell out because they couldn't access anything and other people who were just like, sweet, day off, you know, chilling out, reading the paper, like just having a good time.
Yeah, I mean, if Teams is down, then ain't nothing getting done. So, yeah, I'm sure a lot of people had a pretty cruisy day.
Yeah, it can be good. It can be bad. It really depends on your job.
Yep, exactly. Ah, dear.
Adam, that is it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure as always. And we will probably chat next week. But Mrs. Biz and I, we're down to the any day now phase of the pregnancy. After next week's show, I'm definitely off for 3 weeks. But it could be, yeah, as I say, it could be any day from now. I might just disappear for a few weeks, just so you all know.
Well, I hope it goes well, and perhaps I'll talk to you next week, perhaps not. Either way, I'm sure bad things will happen whilst you're off. That's just how things are.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Paul Lanzi of Remediant. Remediant make a PAM solution that is actually pretty clever. You drop their virtual or physical appliance on your network, and it can basically go out and remove privilege from all of your privileged accounts and then re-enable it for short periods when people need to use those accounts. So in that sense, it's like other PAM solutions because it does the time lock thing, but it is easier to deploy and use. Now, one of the shortcomings of most PAM solutions is how you're going to deal with service accounts, right? Because you can't just remove privilege from them and then switch to a just-in-time model. So one of the feature requests Remediant was getting was for them to integrate their solution with EDR suites. And the idea is that if a box has been popped, you can deal with the fallout of the exposed accounts on that machine network-wide very quickly and in an automated way. So here's Paul Lanzi to explain that.
So we had done a survey with a research agency called EMA a little while ago. And one of the questions we asked was, hey, you know, users of PAM solutions, what do you wish your PAM solution integrated with? And the number one answer, and I'm not talking about by a little bit, like the number one answer by a lot, was EDR. And I looked at Tim, my co-founder, and I said, Tim, what PAM and EDR solutions integrate with each other? He's like, none do. Like, and so we're like, what is the community trying to tell us here, right? Like, what is this actually?
Yeah, what's the use case? Did it leap out at you immediately, or did you have to go and say, hang on, why do people want this integration?
I wish I could say I was so smart that it was like instant dawning on inspiration, but no, we had to think about this one for a little bit. There's actually a couple of use cases once you dig into it, right? So the EDR solutions by and large are, as the name might imply, very endpoint focused. They're thinking about computers, right? Like that's what they're really good at doing. They're really good at hardening them. They're really good at doing threat prevention on them. That's what they exist to do. But the problem from an identity perspective is privilege access can be used to move laterally between these endpoints. And if the endpoint-centric security solution doesn't know anything about privilege access, doesn't know anything about who can move laterally in these environments,
it's all going to look totally normal.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so we're like, well, shoot, like what could we do if we bring PAM and EDR together and we bring some identity concepts into this endpoint-centric security world? And what if we bring about a story of an identity-enabled response to some of the EDR solutions and use cases? And that was the inspiration.
So talk to us about what that means in a concrete way, right? Because I understand, yeah, making your EDR sort of aware of which identities are supposed to be where and, you know, authorizations and blah, 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 right? Okay, high level, I kind of understand it, but walk us through what it looks like in practice.
So let's say you're dealing with a situation where you've got an endpoint that's been compromised and the EDR solution has picked up, you know, malware.exe is running on this endpoint and it puts that endpoint into, you know, isolation. The challenge, and we've seen this, and we talked about this last time, we've seen malware start to scrape valid credentials out of memory and then use those credentials to move laterally. Well, if you're an EDR solution that doesn't know anything about what credentials were at risk, it can't really do a lot to stop that lateral movement. But if that EDR solution can then call our solution, SecureOne, and say, hey, this endpoint was compromised. Tell me all the accounts that might have been compromised because that endpoint was compromised. We can look in our data set and say, yep, here's the set of accounts that had privilege access over the last 30 days, whether it was persistent writes or just-in-time access. These are the accounts that are potentially at risk of being compromised because that endpoint was compromised. And then we can do an identity-enabled response and go and lock down the privilege access for those accounts, either on a permanent basis or on a temporary basis, to prevent the lateral spread of whatever badness it was that the EDR solution detected on that endpoint.
Now, have you set this up to be like, and I'm guessing this is still an open question for you, but I'm still going to ask it, but is this something that you're doing in auto mode, or is it something that actually requires some intervention? Because I'd imagine like it would be most effective if it's just auto mode, but then bad things can happen when you start locking the wrong accounts and things like that.
Yeah, it'll depend on the customer and what their specific environmental needs are and the risk assessment for those individual endpoints. So I think that it'll be capable of operating either way, but it'll be down to the customer to decide how they want to configure that. And again, that'll be a configuration on the EDR side. But there's more. Hold on, there's more. So another really interesting use case that came out of this was, today SecureOne is an on-prem solution that contacts endpoints directly, right? So it just makes these connections. It manages a privilege access, detects privilege access, does just-in-time, all the cool stuff that SecureOne does. But in order to do that stuff, it requires direct network line of sight today. And the other thing that we figured out we could do is to use the EDR solution's live response APIs to say, hey, if I can't talk to the system directly, let's relay that request, that privilege access just-in-time request or that rotating of a password request or whatever it is we want to do around privilege access on that endpoint. We can relay that request through the EDR's cloud and then hit the endpoint and have that change affected without us having to have our own agent on the endpoint. So it's a way of bringing sort of an agent-ish solution to PAM to the endpoint without having to install an additional agent.
Now, I can see that, in an age of exploding agent counts, I can't believe we're back there again in 2021, mm-hmm. but it's a mm-hmm. thing. Yeah, I can see that using someone else's agent, that's going to make a lot of sense, right? And I think, we're going to see more and more people trying to squeeze more functions out of the one agent. I wonder how long it's going to be before sort of EDR and, patch management and workload management, that all fuses together. I think that's coming, but that's just me.
I don't know. I don't know a single IT administrator that'll be sad when that day arrives.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, that's why I kind of think it's inevitable, right? If you've got these EDR clients that kind of have Trojan-like capabilities on them, why would you not then get them to do other stuff? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that we were really pleasantly surprised but how easy it was to do this. So the EDR solution that we're integrating with Carbon Black, they have a publicly documented API that was super straightforward. I mean, we didn't even need their help actually to build this integration. It took us just a couple of weeks to build out this integration just based on their publicly documented API. And so this capability, this identity-enabled response capability is going to be pretty cool. And it was really straightforward to develop.
As you mentioned earlier, that first use case of determining which accounts have been popped if a box gets compromised, I mean, that is pretty useful. Compromising accounts in an environment protected by your gear only gets you so far because most of the privileged accounts are going to have just-in-time access enabled, right? Which is kind of your whole thing. I'm guessing this is going to be most useful in figuring out which service accounts have been compromised because they're the ones that you can't do just-in-time for. Have I got that about right?
100%. You got it exactly right. The other risk there is around the accounts that currently have a just-in-time session active. What can we do around those?
So if you're dealing with a live attacker who's trying to do lateral movement like right then, that's going to be, you might want to shut off that. You might want to shut off that privilege pretty quick, right?
That's right. And we're doing it within a couple hundred milliseconds is one of the core competencies of what our platform does. So this is all sort of in furtherance of this idea of a cybersecurity mesh. The big picture here is that what we're trying to do differently than other providers in the space is be a fully integrated PAM solution, right? I've believed for so long, and part of the reason I helped create Remediant was that PAM for too long has been its own little special island that didn't integrate with much, even in the IIM world. And it just doesn't feel like that's a sustainable strategy ongoing. We, the industry, need to do something better around this. So creating the cybersecurity mesh and being really making it easy to integrate these products together and actually deliver customer value is a key thing that we're trying to do.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, security, so much of the security market is, you know, all of these products are being turned into APIs that just sort of sing and dance and interact with each other in these sort of integrations. As you said, it took you 2 weeks, right? So I can imagine that we're going to see more of these sort of integrations in the future. I mean, yeah, there's some other ones that I'm aware that are going on that, like, other sponsors, they haven't announced them yet, but there's some other stuff that they're doing that's, yeah, along similar lines in terms of just, well, hang on, if we make this thing work with this thing, we can do all of this. Yeah, there's some very obvious integrations that should be happening, aren't there?
I think so. In this EDR integration is not the last one that we're planning. There's a bunch more that we have sort of in the pipeline that you and I will get to talk about next time.
Drop some hints. Like, what else can you do? Like, you're talking about the need to integrate PAM with other things. Like, what are some of the other areas where it makes sense to plummet through to other kit? Like, you know, drop a hint.
Yeah, well, you know, last time you and I talked about incident response. And so, you know, think about what are the platforms that incident responders care a lot about? What do they live in day to day? And what would be enabled if those sort of incident response focused platforms had some element of identity enablement in them, and especially around privilege access? You know, what could that unlock for us?
So basically having like your SIEM IR playbook spring up with a list of compromised usernames, that sort of thing. And then, yeah, I suppose that's a sensible point of integration because they are already set up to ingest data from everywhere, right? I mean, that's what you're getting at, yeah?
Yeah, digest data, but also take action on, you know, the risk, right, in helping to mitigate risk very rapidly. So that's definitely a thing that we're thinking a lot about. How do we help those incident responders get control over identities during an incident very rapidly?
So orchestration.
Head in that direction.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, Paul, I understand that you've been involved in helping to stand up an identity day on April 13, which is the most Paul Lanzi thing I've ever heard of. Please tell us about that.
Well, I am like the smallest player of the smallest player in creation of Identity Management Day, but I am very proud to be a small part of it. So the Identity Defined Security Alliance, the IDSA, has really spearheaded the creation of Identity Management Day on April 13th. And it's really meant to educate and emphasize the importance of identity management within the larger cybersecurity sphere. And so really bringing some attention to all the good work that we've been doing in identity management and making that easier to do and more secure and easier to deploy over the past few years, bringing some attention and bringing that.
And what happens on Identity Management Day? Do you have like cupcakes? Are there presentations? Like what is it?
Yeah. So I wish we had cupcakes. Maybe we'll have to plan that for next year. But for this year, we're at least going to do some webinars on, you know, how do you bring identity management? How do you mature your identity management practices in your organization? Some great webinars from Remediant and from others. We've got blog articles out there. And we're actually doing this not just within IDSA, but across a number of other industry groups as well to promote thinking about how do you protect your own identities as well from a consumer perspective. So it's not just about enterprise identities, but also consumer identities as well.
All right. You heard it here first. Identity Management. What is it? Identity Management Day? Awareness
Identity
Day?
Management Day. That's right.
Identity Management Day. April 13. Much excite. Paul Lanzi, it's always great to talk to you, my friend. Thank you very much for that. And we'll chat to you again soon.
All right. What a pleasure. Thanks, Pat.
That was Paul Lanzi from Remediant there. And yeah, they launched their Carbon Black integration today. And you can check them out at Remediant.com. Big thanks to Remediant for sponsoring this week's show. But yeah, that is it for this week's episode. I'll be back with some more risky business next week, I think, maybe. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.